Hello, and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews from Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and coming up first is Media Matters host Max Blumenthal from Sunday, November 15, 2009. Mr. Blumenthal discusses his book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. And then after that, from December 17, 2009, Stuart Schultz interviews Naomi Klein, journalist and author of The Shock Doctrine. They talk about Hillary Clinton's surprise press conference at the Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen. And then, after that, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Colbert.
Our guest, Max Blumenthal. This is Media Matters. Let's go to our last phone call now. I've been waiting very patiently. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I'll try to talk quick. I have not had a chance to read the book, and I'm dying to read the book. I did want to ask, wasn't John Hagee Bush's personal spiritual advisor throughout his 8 years?
He was not. Bush had a variety of spiritual advisors, and Hagee wasn't among them, although he was, I can't even document, the White House just released its visitor log from the Bush years, and I haven't heard about him being there, although I do know that James Dobson was once welcomed to the Bush White House for a meeting on Iran policy, which is sort of disturbing, and I assume Hagee was also in the room, but Hagee was not. He was, however, attempt to position himself as a spiritual advisor to John McCain during the 2008 campaign when he endorsed McCain. Of course, McCain didn't believe in anything Hagee believed in. It was a cynical political ploy, and it blew up in McCain's face when Hagee was revealed as a Holocaust revisionist who had said that the Holocaust was a divinely ordained phenomenon designed by God to bring the Jews to Israel to fulfill biblical prophecy. McCain had to cut him loose and said, the reason I picked Hagee was bad vetting. Then he goes ahead and selects Sarah Palin as vice president, so I don't think he'd really tightened up his vetting process very much.
Caller, are you still there? I guess the caller is gone, too. Well, let's wrap up with just a couple of looking forward, if we can, Max Blumenthal. I mean, two key figures in the book. You've already spoken at length about Sarah Palin. Another crucial figure on the political horizon, Mike Huckabee, shows up in the book at a number of points. And these seem to be, if I'm correct, the two present politicians angling to be the top dog, so to speak, of the Christian right in the 2012 presidential race. And then the third character who shows up in your book, and this, I hesitate to use the term pathetic, would be Mitt Romney, who sort of did whatever he could to appeal to the right. What's your sense of the Republican Party presidential aspirants right now and their relationship to the political right?
Well, Romney and Pawlenty are the two front runners. They're going to attempt to run the campaign around the economy. Romney's an economics expert who, to his credit, understands how the economy works. I disagree with his remedy for the economy. He favors outsourcing the American workforce and has been paid as a consultant to help companies outsource for years. And I was just talking to a leading social conservative who's been close to Bush and McCain, and he told me if Romney or Pawlenty attempt to focus the campaign on the economy, we will sabotage them. We're going to force them to talk about social issues, and if they don't use the language we want them to use, we'll destroy them. And I do agree that's what would happen. Pawlenty and Romney are seen, besides the fact that Romney's a Mormon, as inauthentic cardboard men in suits by the evangelical movement and by the Catholic right. And that means that they're going to have to nominate, if they get the election, a vice president in the mold of Palin or Huckabee. Huckabee's going to run. He can't win, but he's going to run for vice president. And Sarah Palin, whether she runs or not, is a folk hero to the Republican Party, the most nationally recognized figure, and the whole campaign will be run in her shadow. We've already seen a moderate Republican Senate candidate from Illinois, Mark Kirk, who's pro-choice, solicit Sarah Palin's endorsement to fend off a challenge from his right. He's terrified of Palin and the influence she commands. And that scenario will replicate itself in 2012 through Romney or Pawlenty. who will need Sarah Palin's endorsement to move forward into a general campaign.
So if I understand your argument, Max Lowenthal, at least one of the two positions on the 2012 ticket will have to be someone certified and personally approved by James Dobson and his crew.
Whether it's Dobson or not, it will be someone who is in the mold of Dobson, whose mentality and political sensibility has been cultivated through the influence of Dobson. And Sarah Palin, who is anointed by Dobson, will be one of the figures to do the vetting. The movement is still able to command the Republican grassroots.
Well, on that note, Max Blumenthal, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear us out of the studio. I want to thank Max Blumenthal, our guest today, the author of the new book by Nation Books, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Max, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Foxy. Huh. And you know you're a sweet little lovemaker. Foxy. Listen up. Foxy, I see you all the time down on the sea. Foxy, ooh, so fine, you make me want to get up and scream. Listen here, woman. I've made up my mind. Sick and tired of wasting my precious time. You got to be all right, all right. Foxy lady, uh-huh.
TV. The world is thinking.
Stuart Schulzke here in Copenhagen for Fora TV. Very fortunately with Naomi Klein, given that she seems to have lost her voice. Do you care to comment on the voice loss issue?
Yeah, this is... I have laryngitis. I have the worst laryngitis I've ever had. So I'm a bit like a walking metaphor because I literally don't have my voice, which is very frustrating because I was just in a press conference with Hillary Clinton and really wanted to ask her a question. But voicelessness is really the theme of the final days of the Copenhagen Summit. You know, the NGOs, the youth delegations have all been kicked out. And they're putting up signs, you know, outside with people's mouths being taped shut because they've lost their voice. And then all the developing countries, including the G77, are saying that they've lost their voice, that all the deals are being made behind closed doors. They've been working for months. And suddenly these texts are appearing out of thin air that were negotiated behind closed doors. So I feel like a walking metaphor because I'm here, but...
It's actually kind of profound in a way.
Oh. Or it's just a cheap ploy, I don't know.
Exactly. Well, then what we would actually like, A, if you could ask the question that you were not able to ask of Hillary Clinton, and then maybe answer it, or give your own comments on the Secretary's statement this afternoon.
I would like to talk about it, because I think what we saw from Hillary Clinton was the unveiling of a new era of climate structural adjustment. For those of you unfamiliar with the term, structural adjustment is what the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank used to do. They still do it, but they don't use the term anymore because it's got such a bad reputation. But when poor countries would desperately need a loan, the World Bank or the IMF would give a list of conditions. Okay, we'll give you the loan, but only if you privatize your water and your electricity and you let our corporations in and just adjust yourself to our terms. This is a really, really hated phrase in the Global South. But what Hillary Clinton just did is she walked into that meeting and she said, these are our terms, kill Kyoto, no legally binding agreements, only transparency, whatever the hell that means, no global emission target, emission cut targets, but everybody go off, make your national plan, and then we'll mash them together, which means there isn't a global goal. And also, forget about the whole idea of historical responsibility. She even said something about how some people want to look back, but we want to look forward. Historical responsibility is a hugely important factor here in these negotiations because in the climate convention that the U.S. signed, it states clearly that the responsibility for solving the climate crisis rests primarily with the countries that created the crisis, the developed countries, the industrialized countries. Not that developing countries don't need to do anything, but that rich countries that created the climate crisis clearly have to take the lead. So she rejected that whole concept out of hand. She laid out the terms, and then she said, and we agreed to $100 billion for some climate fund, vaguely defined, that will be available to poor countries to deal with things like floods, droughts, malaria, by 2020. So here's the money, and then she explicitly said, but the U.S. will not contribute anything unless you agreed to these terms. So it was climate blackmail or climate structural adjustment. And my question is really, what about the principle that the polluter pays? In other words, who is the U.S. to set the terms of this agreement when, in fact, the U.S. as a country bears the greatest responsibility for the creation of the crisis? So this is what, you know, this phrase climate justice is all about. It's the idea that we have to look at historical responsibility because then you have a much more equal negotiation because countries come to the table with the idea that actually they're owed something because they're living the effects of a problem that they didn't create.
Your voice is actually holding out fairly well.
Actually, it's not. I think you should leave it there. I'm sorry.
That's absolutely
fine. I need to leave a tiny bit.
You've been very generous. Once again, Stuart Schulzke in Copenhagen with great luck with Naomi Klein. And we'll wrap up.
Thank you so much.
Once again, we look to England for great oratory. Tony Blair, militant liberal. Over here in America, George W. Bush, compassionate conservative. I don't know what that is. Relay it. Kind of sounds like a Volvo with a gun rack. I don't know why. Okay. Over here, Tony Blair, a man who must address the House of Commons, which is like Congress with a two-drink minimum. They yell shit back. It's like, my worthy opponent, oh, fuck off! Eat shite, you buggery bastard! Move on! Will someone remove Mrs. Thatcher from the hall, please? But after 9/11, it was Tony who said, this heinous incident has brought our civilization to the edge of oblivion, but we shall endure. And there's poor W going, shit, I can't even spell that. Damn! You know, you look at him, he's got a short attention span. He's going, I know our economy. Oh, look at the kitty. He's got to have backup. Basically, if you look at it in the classical sense, it's secundo gentia. George II, the boy king, a man we thought could only lose, but somehow won because of confused Hebrews. Yes. Yes. Some men are born great, some achieve greatness, some get it as a graduation gift. That's okay. Because here's the thing. Notice, W doesn't speak while Cheney's drinking water. Check that shit out. With Cheney, though, even when he had angioplasty, you know, blessed are the pacemakers. They protected him. He walked out that next day. He was there, ready to go again. Some people would let it heal. No, he's like, I am perfectly fine. And there's Ashcroft in the back going, work the arms, you prick, work the arms. You have to remember one thing. John Ashcroft is a man who lost to a dead man in Missouri. In Missouri, the choices were dead man, John Ashcroft. And the people in Missouri, in their wisdom, went, sorry, John, but I'm going to have to vote for the dead man because he scares me less than you do. Now, it doesn't scare me that W waved at Stevie Wonder. That's okay. Now, come on. Stevie's only been blind since birth. Stevie! Even Stevie's going, is that motherfucker waving at me? Oh, man. What scares me is that W almost died from a pretzel. We have billions of dollars in National Security Secret Service men talking into their sleeves. They have spy satellites, F-18 flying, air cover for Washington, and he goes down from fucking snack food. Secret Service are going, game's over, man!
Gilligan's down, Gilligan's down.
What do we have to do? Does someone have to sit with him and go, chew, sir? Now fluid, sir! Even his own dogs didn't give a shit. They were licking him for the salt. You need a dog that cares. A dog that'll go get help, like Lassie. A dog that'll go, woo, woo, woo. Woo, woo, woo. What is it, Lassie? The president swallowed something and we need to do the Heimlich? Woo, woo. What else is wrong, girl? Woo, 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 woo. Mr. Cheney's meeting with the Enron people? Woo, woo, woo. And giving tax rebates? Woo, woo! And there's a lot of former Enron employees in the White House? Woo, 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 woo! Sorry, girl, we're gonna have to put you down now. Because...
Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill. Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill. We went out tiger hunting. Accidents, he always took his mom. He's the all-American bullet-headed Saxon mother's son.
All insurance sing.
Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill. Captain Marvel zapped him right between the eyes.
Zap! All the children sing.
Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill. Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill.
The children asked him if to kill was not a sin. His mommy petted him.
If looks could kill, it would have been us instead of him.
All the children sing.
Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill. Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill?
Bungalow.
Uncle Sam is acting tough. America has had enough. Georgie boy is really mad. He's bombing Baghdad for his dad. All this toil over aisles on the boil. We're all bored with rattling swords. Yeah. Wave your flag, now wave your fist. It's your decision. Everybody knows it's wrong. And it's not in my name. Not in my name. I said it's not in my name. It's not in my name. Ba da ba 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 da ba 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 da ba 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 ba. Bend and break to the politicians' will. The world moves forward, they stand still. Raise a cheer as the troop ships go sailing off for an Alamo. All this toil over oils on the boil. We're all bored with rattling swords. Yeah. Wave your flag or wave your fist. It's your decision. Everybody knows it's wrong. And it's not in my name. 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 No, it's not in my name. It's not in my name. Said it's not in my name. It's not in my name. Say, can you see by the dawn's early light? A nation of violence and military might. Land of the brave, it's the home of the free. Bombing and bombing for democracy. Yeah. Well, it's not in my name. I said it's not in my name. No, it's not in my name. I said it's not in my name. No, it's not in my name. Oh, no, it's not in my name. It's not in my name.